Hi, this is Marlene with Miami Ghost Chronicles, and I want to welcome you to another episode of Stories of the Supernatural. Wherever you find us, whether it's a video or podcast on your favorite platform, please like and subscribe to us so that you can get notification of when a new show is released. You can also find us on major social media platforms. If you go to MiamiGhostChronicles.com, you can find links to the videos or MP3 files, which you can download and enjoy without commercial interruptions. If you're into classic horror, ghost, and adventure stories, I narrate Nightshade Diary, and you can find links at nightshadediary.com. If scary stories are your bag, and listening to encounters with cryptids, ghosts, dogmen, and other weird creatures sends a shiver up your spine, then go to supernaturalstorytime.com for links to our weekly podcasts. Noteworthy news about the paranormal world, true crime, conspiracy stories, and anything that is just plain weird can be found at eerie.news or visit the Stranger Than Fiction Stories tab at MiamiGhostChronicles.com. Please subscribe to my newsletter on Substack. Just go to mppelliser.com for a link. I want to thank you for being part of my audience, and I think you are all wonderful. Hi, this is Marlene with Stories of the Supernatural. And this week, again, I don't have a regular guest. Instead, I wanted to look in on a very interesting case. Some of you may have heard about it. This had to do with a gentleman named James Maybrick, who has been, not accused, but that there's some type of evidence that points that he might have been the Jack the Ripper, because at this point there's been so many candidates that we're not sure. But what's really interesting is what was going on with his wife and her mother and everything. It's quite a scandal, especially since this took place supposedly in the Age of Innocence. And the title of this episode is The Adventures of Carrie, Florrie, and Jack the Ripper. Now, Carolyn Carrie Holbrook and her daughter Florence Florrie Chandler moved in the highest circles of American and European society. As Victorian ladies, they were taught to run from any hint of scandal. But by the time they passed from this life, their names were linked to infidelity, secret marriages, murder, and even Jack the Ripper. During her youth, Caroline Holbrook raised eyebrows, and only her family ties and wealth kept her from being completely ostracized from polite society. However, it was not until her daughter, Florence Chandler Maybrick, was accused of poisoning her husband that the rest of the world learned of several sordid stories she thought had long been buried. The implications of the newspaper articles were obvious, which was the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. But let's go back to the beginning. Carolyn Holbrook was born in 1838 to Darius Holbrook and Elizabeth Ingram. Both of her parents could trace their family history back to the 17th century and pre-revolutionary times. In 1856, she went to visit her uncle, Reverend Joseph H. Ingram, in Mobile, Alabama. She met her first husband, William Chandler, who was the head of St. John Powers and Company, a famous banking house, during that visit. They married in 1858. Caroline Chandler was described as, quote, a brilliant society woman, stylish, though not pretty, end quote. She gave birth to their first child, Holbrook, in their first year of marriage. In the third year of their marriage, William Chandler, who was 32 years old, fell ill. Caroline tended him at their home, and none of his relatives were permitted to see him. He died on July 8, 1862. She was 8 months pregnant with her second child, Florence, who was born in September of that same year. There are different stories as to what took place after Chandler's death. The family grew suspicious and supposedly made life so impossible for Caroline that she left for Macon, Georgia. Some say their hostility towards her was due to the fact that she was a northerner and Alabama was part of the Confederacy during the Civil War. There was also whispers of poisoning. Now, allegedly, Caroline claimed her young husband died because of the anxiety he felt due to his responsibility as head of the St. John Powers and Company. In his will, Mr. Chandler urged his wife to return to New York, but that his son should be raised by his maternal grandmother. Caroline Chandler did not comply with either of these wishes. Some versions said that Caroline had met a certain Captain Frank Du Barry while she was still married, as he was a friend of the family, and another placed their meeting later when she left for Macon, Georgia, or possibly when she worked at a Civil War hospital in Charleston. Wherever the truth lies, less than 2 years later she had married Captain Du Barry. Here again there is a divergence of stories. In one version, he was sent to Europe representing the Confederate Army, possibly to buy ammunition. The second story is that he headed to the Bahamas to improve his health since he suffered from consumption. The Du Barrys, along with the children, left on the steamship Fanny, which managed to get away from the blockade vessels stationed off the coast of Wilmington. In the early hours of May 27, 1864, 150 miles out to sea, Captain Du Barry became ill. By the end of the day, he had died. He was 27 years old. It was said the captain of the ship wanted to return to Wilmington so Du Barry could be interred on hallowed ground. The Du Barrys were themselves a prominent family. His father, Dr. Du Barry, had been the United States Navy surgeon. He had four brothers and one sister still alive. However, Mrs. Du Barry insisted he should be buried at sea. The notice of his death was posted from Nassau a few days later. In the span of 5 years, Carrie Chandler Du Barry had become a bride and widow twice. Contrary to the saying that you can never go home, Caroline did exactly that. She joined her mother Elizabeth, who was by then a widow still living in New York. Her frequent companion was her cousin, Frank Armstrong Crawford Vanderbilt, whose family of origin were the Crawfords out of Mobile, Alabama. And by the way, Frank is a girl. The city, once the capital of then French Louisiana, had been the winter retreat for wealthy New England families who built their mansions on Government Street. It was not until the scandal of her daughter's trial that a secret marriage between Caroline and a certain Charles Rebello came to light. It took place in 1866 in Newark, New Jersey. In some instances, he was described as an exiled Italian count. Some newspapers confused him with Charles Rebello, who served as the British vice consul at Cuba in 1861, or another Charles Rebello, who was a reporter for the New York Sun. The worst, but probably the most accurate connection, was that he was an actor she had become involved with after she returned to New York. Mr. Rebello, if that was his real name, crossed paths with Caroline, who possibly at that point wanted a husband with a title. She had wealth not only from her husband's, but through her father's inheritance. So Mr. Rebello made himself Count Rebello. How long did it take for Caroline to realize the truth is unknown. She claimed during the divorce that he abandoned her within 24 hours of their marriage and set sail on a ship headed to Venezuela, South America. According to her, they had never consummated the marriage, and that she was unaware that he married her only to gain possessions of her lands. This explanation begs the question, why would he leave? Within a year of the marriage, she brought suit in 1867 in Floyd County Circuit Court at New Albany, but it was dismissed on January 4, 1868. A few days later, Caroline Rebello, with her mother and her children, established temporary residence in Columbus, Indiana. They were accompanied by two lawyers, Colonel A.T. Haughey and Colonel Thomas B. Farley. Caroline stated that Rebello had compelled her to marry him through duress, fraud, and misrepresentation. Within 2 months, the divorce was granted, and the ladies and the children immediately left Indiana. Once she could marry again, Caroline sailed to Europe with her children. There she met Baron Heinrich Louis Adolf von Roeck, a cavalry officer in the 8th Cuirassier Regiment of the German Army. They married on April 4, 1872, in West Baden, Germany. He was born December 22, 1845, and she gave her birthday on the marriage record as February 4, 1846, when in reality the actual birth was 1838. In other words, she didn't want to appear what she actually was, which was older than the bridegroom. Scandal trailed behind Caroline like a faithful puppy. Shortly after her marriage, she confronted her new husband about his infidelities. He beat her, so she left him, but took her title of baroness with her. After this, she allegedly became involved with a Mr. Haggard, who was an attaché of the British legation at Tehran, Persia. He was the brother of Sir H. Rider Haggard, who wrote King Solomon's Mines, among other adventure stories. Rumors were they lived as husband and wife, and that he was in full knowledge of her history. In 1889, J. Treve Edgecombe, Inner Temple, London, published a statement given by Caroline Baroness von Roque, who was then living in Rouen, France, about the scandal involving her daughter. Quote, she described where her first husband had died from inflammation of the brain, caused by tension and anxiety because of his heavy financial responsibility his firm had during the Civil War. 18 months later, she worked at the hospital in Charleston and married Frank de Bury after he was brought in after sustaining a wound in battle. She, along with his brother, took him on board a blockade runner which was chased by U.S. gunboats from Wilmington to Nassau. He died en route and was buried at sea. In 1873, she married Baron von Rokes, who was still alive at that time. She was outraged by the scandal printed that she had been somehow culpable of the death of her first two husbands, which she thought would prejudice her daughter's upcoming trial. She disclosed that she was a member of the American Women's Masonic Lodge of the Eastern Star under direction of the Grand Masonic Lodge of the New York State. End quote. Baroness von Roque educated her children in Europe, but did visit New York during those years. It was on a trip returning to Europe in 1880 that 18-year-old Florence Chandler met Mr. James Maybrick, 43, a wealthy merchant from Liverpool. They married in 1881 and had two children, James in 1882 and Gladys in 1886. During these years, Florence's brother, Holbrook St. John Campbell Chandler, studied medicine in Paris but died from a lingering illness in 1885 when he was 26 years old. He did not live to witness the scandal his sister would be embroiled in only a few years later. The Maybricks, to all appearances, seemed a happy couple, but Florence soon learned that her husband was a hypochondriac. Eccentricities of this nature could be overlooked. However, infidelity was not. During the first 6 years of the marriage, Maybrick prospered and paid for his bastard children and his former mistress. According to English law, he was responsible for the five children he fathered until they were 16 years old, as well as their mother. Then, in 1887, his business declined, and when he failed in his payments, the mistress wrote him a letter which came into the hands of Florence. This prompted Mrs. Maybrick to visit a lawyer in London to consult upon a divorce. Perhaps the attorney advised against it. These were the times where James would be criticized, not for his infidelity, but more for indiscretion in allowing his wife to become aware of his affairs. A husband could obtain a divorce with only a claim of infidelity. A wife's bar was set much higher. She had to prove desertion, sodomy, or other type of deviant behavior in order to secure divorce. And afterwards, a divorcee faced silent but relentless disapproval from society. Whichever the case, she decided to pay her husband back in kind and started an affair with Alfred Brierly, a merchant who ran in their same social circle. Maybrick became aware of it and was furious when they attended the Grand National Day at Aintree and Florence walked up the course with Brierly. All of their friends were present, and this doubled Maybrick's ire. Once home, they fought, and he struck her. The rift was so deep that Maybrick drew up a new will, leaving everything to his children and excluding Florence. Dr. Hopper, the family physician, was aware that James Maybrick was regularly added arsenic to a cup of beef tea, and he also drank a preparation containing strychnine. He had warned him several times against taking these poisons. On May 27, 1889, James complained of feeling sick, and asked Dr. Humphrey, who regularly attended his children, to come see him. He diagnosed Maybrick with dyspepsia and put him on a diet. He got better, returned to work, but by the weekend he vomited constantly and complained of pains in his legs, and his hands felt numb. He felt better. However, his brother Edwin, who was staying at the house, brought in Dr. Carter for a second opinion. He concurred with Dr. Humphrey's diagnosis and confirmed that he needed to be meticulous about what he ate. Mrs. Hughes, a family friend, sent a telegram to Michael Maybrick, who lived in London. She also told Florence to bring a nurse to look after James. On that day, Florence gave the nanny, Alice Yap, a letter to post. Whether intentionally or by accident, the letter was given to Florence's son to hold, and he dropped it in a puddle on the way to the post office. This allegedly gave the nurse an excuse to open it and clean it up. It was addressed to Brierly, and the intimate words left no doubt about the relationship between them. The nanny gave the letter to Edwin Maybrick, who ironically was also supposed to have been involved romantically with his sister-in-law. The family forbade Florence from tending to her husband and locked her in the house, while they ransacked every closet and drawer in the house. James' condition worsened in the following days. However, a sample of his feces and urine did not show any trace of arsenic. He continued to worsen, and the doctors warned the family recovery was not possible. Supposedly an envelope marked arsenic, poison for cats, was found in Florence's room. An autopsy completed on May 13th found James Maybrick had died due to an irritant poison. Traces of strychnine, hycosine, morphia, and prussic acid were found, but the latter two were to be expected as they had been contained in the medicines administered to the dead man. Florence was arrested, and her trial started on July 31st, 1889. All the doctors that testified agreed his death had been caused by gastroenteritis, but couldn't conclude if it was caused by bad food, a chill, or arsenic. During the trial, Mrs. Maybrick's New York lawyers brought to light that James Maybrick was addicted to the arsenic habit. This challenged the accusation that Mrs. Maybrick had laced her husband's food with arsenic. They described Maybrick as a morphine and strychnine fiend. He'd been addicted for 12 years, and a former valet for Maybrick testified to his habit of eating arsenic. He wrote in the affidavit, "He, James Maybrick, took all kinds of medicines, patented and prescribed, and his room looked like a drugstore." The judge used a disclosure that Florence had an affair with Brierly as proof she was capable of killing her husband. The all-male jury returned a guilty verdict within 45 minutes and sentenced her to death by hanging on August 26, 1889. Her sentence was commuted to life imprisonment 5 days before her execution, and she was sent to Aylesworth Prison to serve her sentence. During the time of her incarceration, Florence Maybrick received 7 offers of marriage. James FitzJames Stephen, the judge, had suffered a paralyzing seizure 3 years before the trial, and within 2 years after the trial, he was retired due to senile decay and sent to an asylum. He died in 1894. He was rewarded by Queen Victoria with a baronetcy and an annuity of £3,500. Sir Charles Russell, the Attorney General, and a memorandum to the Home Office, pointed out the judge had, quote, passionately invited them to find a verdict of guilty, end quote. He made suggestions that had never been advanced by the prosecution and went out of his way to make misleading references. It was noted in the newspapers after Florence's conviction, Sir James FitzJames Stephens, who was much prejudiced against wives suspected of misbehavior, had worked himself up into a kind of frenzy when he thought of Mrs. Maybrick becoming a popular heroine. According to the Fremont County Standard in Minnesota, dated August 15, 1889, read, after the verdict became known, thousands of people assembled around the entrance to the courtroom and waited for the departure of the judge. As soon as he made his appearance, he was greeted with howls of rage, and the hooting of the crowd was kept up for a long time. There were incessant cries of shame, and an attack upon the judge's carriage was only prevented by the active interference of the police. The feeling in Liverpool against the verdict is intense. steps have been taken to secure a stay of execution on the ground of the discovery of further medical evidence. Florence's grandfather, Darius Holbrook, died in 1858, leaving an estate valued at $1 million, which he divided between his wife and children. Darius Holbrook, Florence's uncle, died in 1875. That same year, Elizabeth Holbrook, her grandmother, executed a deed trust to her daughter Caroline before leaving on a trip to Germany, where she died in 1876. The family home in New York went to her two grandchildren. So what's happened is that by the time that Caroline, of course, is older and Florence is being prosecuted for murder, they're both very wealthy women. The husbands have died. Well, the Baroness, not yet. Her husband doesn't die till 1912, but her father, her brother, her uncle, the grandmother, everybody has passed away and left everything to Caroline and the family home to both of the grandchildren, one of them, of course, being Florence. Now, by then, Caroline understood too well the cost of marrying for a title. Her husband's creditors, after exhausting requests for payment from Baron von Rokas, tried to levy the house left to Florence Maybrick. The attorneys Rowan Macklin won the lawsuit for Florence and her brother. They had been handling legal matters for the Holbrook family for many years. In 1902, Harriet Hubbard Eyre, a reporter for the New York World, visited Florence Maybrick, who by then had served 13 years in prison. She had not seen her children for several years and did not know of their whereabouts. She then went to visit Baroness de Roques, who lived in France. The reporter described where the Baroness lived on the outskirts of Rouen in a small house, which she called a poor little refuge. She had lived there for 10 years, attended only by one servant. The Baron had already died. Much of their fortune had been spent in defending Florence. During those years, a letter was received by the county clerk for Columbus, Indiana, inquiring about a divorce procured by Baroness von Rokes. It was thought that Count Rebello was bringing suit to the divorce granted to Baroness von Rokes, as he was trying to recover an interest in large land estates his wife had and several southern states. The divorce seemed to be legal since no more was heard of Count Rebello. In other words, he was challenging that they really weren't really truly divorced because he wanted to get a hold of her money and, of course, her land. In 1903, the Baroness and her daughter Florence were about to lose title to over 2.5 million acres in Kentucky, Virginia, and West Virginia, valued at over $7.5 million. It seemed that their attorney, W.D. Armstrong, had fraudulently procured their signatures to deeds, claiming they were only for a small portion of the lands, when in fact they were for the entire holdings. He had given the women only $3,000. Florence Maybrick was released in 1904 after serving 15 years in Woking and Aylesbury prisons. This was just in time so she could sign papers that would allow her attorneys to prevent the loss of these tracts of land. She returned to America and wrote a book titled Mrs. Maybrick's Own Story, My 15 Lost Years, and lectured upon her experience during her incarceration. She never saw her children again, who were given to Dr. Charles Chinner Fuller and his wife Gertrude to raise. Her mother, Caroline, died in 1910 and was buried next to her son in a Paris cemetery. For many years, Florence's whereabouts were unknown. Her fortune was gone, and some believe she lived as an indigent in Chicago, when in 1918 she was referred to Henrietta Banwell, who wanted a housekeeper in Gaylordsville, Connecticut. With donated funds, she built a small cabin on Old Stone Road and told everyone her name was Florence Chandler. Her true identity became known when she gave a black lace dress to Genevieve Austin, a neighbor, who found a ticket inside the box with the name Florence Maybrick. A librarian was contacted, who told him the story of the scandalous trial from 30 years before. In an act of kindness, they did not divulge her true name. Florence became more withdrawn and only allowed cats inside her cabin. By 1926, She seemed to be suffering from some type of dementia and lived in squalor. Only through the kindness of her neighbors did she get firewood and help during the Great Depression. In 1941, she fell ill, and Pop Conright, a neighbor, would check on her at least once a day. One day he found her dead inside her home. She died October 23, 1941. It was then that those who knew her real identity revealed it, and the press revisited the case, and how she had been shamefully treated by the English legal system and the Victorian mores of the day. Florence's son, James, started to use the surname of his adopted parents, Fuller. He moved to Canada and went to work as a mining engineer in British Columbia. In 1911, when he was 29, he accidentally took a swallow of cyanide instead of water and died. Her daughter Gladys married Frederick Corbin in 1912. She died in 1971, age 84. James Maybrick attained public attention as the reputed author of the controversial Diary of Jack the Ripper, which surfaced in the early 1990s. It has been proposed that the true author of the diary was Michael Maybrick, who used his brother's death as an opportunity to plant a decoy for his own doings. He died in 1913 and his brother Edwin in 1928. One has to wonder what would have been the fate of Florrie Maybrick and her children if his diary would have been discovered 100 years earlier. But let's get on exactly to that story about what was known as Jack the Ripper's Dear Diary. For over 100 years, the identity and the motive of Jack the Ripper have filled books and inspired movies. Some accurate, others everything but. However, in 2017, a discovery was made that could provide insight into who the disturbed man was. Though suspected of killing prostitutes in Whitechapel, London, during the end of the 19th century have ranged from the well-born to the gutter snipe. Even women have been considered. The only common denominator among them was a twisted psyche, accompanied by intelligence and arrogance. Then in 1992, a 9,000-word memoir by James Maybrick, a cotton merchant, stunned those who had picked over any and all evidence that was tied to Jack the Ripper. In the Victorian diary, he confessed to brutally murdering 5 women in London's East End and another in Manchester. He signed off the diary, quote, "I give my name that all know of me, so history do tell what love can do to a gentleman born, yours truly, Jack the Ripper," end quote. It was not unexpected that many questioned if it was authentic or not. Mike Barrett, a Liverpool scrap metal dealer, said he had come into possession of the diary through Tony Devereaux, a friend, but Devereaux died soon after the diary was published, so he could not explain how he came to discover it. But not all wanted to believe it was a forgery. One of them was a researcher named Bruce Robinson, who went over the story and believed he found evidence of the story's authenticity. The diary was found in Maybrick's former Liverpool home. Robert Smith, who published the book in 1993, believes this information was withheld by Barrett because he feared being prosecuted. Smith said, "When the diary first emerged, Mike Barrett refused to give any satisfactory explanation for where it had come from. But after painstaking research, chiefly by Bruce Robinson, we can now show a trail that leads us directly to Maybrick's home." Maybrick lived in a mansion known as Battle Crease House, located in the Merseyside suburb of Aigburth. He was a wealthy merchant who died in 1889, a year after the killings in Whitechapel. Soon after his death, his wife Florence was arrested and charged with murdering him by poisoning him with arsenic. In 1992, the property was being renovated. Electrical contractors were involved in the work. 3 of them were local men named Arthur Rigby, James Kofopoulos, and Eddie Lyons. They all frequented the same pub as Mike Barrett, a colorful character who boasted about being an author. When they found the diary in March of 1992, they brought it to him hoping he could find a publisher who would be interested in it. On March 9th, Barrett called Doreen Montgomery, a literary agent, and asked, "I've got Jack the Ripper's diary. Would you be interested in seeing it?" In truth, Barrett was not very literate, and many doubted he could produce such a sophisticated forgery. Some said only the killer could have written the diary. Others said it only provided information that was published in the newspapers. In 1995, Mr. Barrett swore an affidavit saying he made the whole thing up. Later, he retracted it. Rigby, Kofopoulos, and Lyons, the electricians working at the Maybrick property, denied being involved in the discovery of the memoir, even though each had slightly different versions of what actually happened. Robert Smith, the publisher, has never wavered from the authenticity of the document. He explained it thus, quote, "I have never been in any doubt that the diary is a genuine document written in 1888 and 1889. The new and indisputable evidence that on March 9, 1992, the diary was removed from under the floorboards of the room that had been James Maybrick's bedroom in 1889 and offered later on the very same day to a London literary agent overrides any other considerations regarding its authenticity. It follows that James Maybrick is its most likely author. Was he Jack the Ripper? He now has to be a prime suspect, but the disputes over the Ripper's identity may well rage for another century at least." In a totally different version of events, Anne Barrett, who was married to Michael Barrett at the time the book was offered to a publisher, said it had been in her family for as long as she could remember, and it was she who gave it to Mr. Devereaux. The reason she gave for not giving the book directly to her husband is that she did not want him to question her estranged father about it. She didn't expect that eventually he would claim that he wrote it himself by dictating it to his wife. Later, he recanted on that story. In 1999, Anne, after her divorce, authored her own book using her maiden name of Graham, titled The Last Victim, The Extraordinary Life of Florence Maybrick, the Wife of Jack the Ripper. Her research led her to believe she was related to Florence Maybrick. Allegedly, Florence gave birth to an illegitimate child when she was 15 years old by a man named Henry Flynn. According to her book, when Florence Maybrick was released in 1904, she started using the surname of Graham. Her son by Flynn was named William Graham, who was Anne's father. The link was Edith Formby, who, according to the Graham family, had attended Florence's trial each day with the nurses in charge of caring for Florence. Her daughter Elizabeth would go on to marry William Billy Graham. So, in conclusion, basically what she's stating is that Anne, her grandmother, would have been Florence Maybrick via that illegitimate child, if that was accurate, that she had when she was 15 years old. Now, how she came into possession of that diary, if you go with that version versus that it was discovered by the electricians, it's not quite accurate or explained if it came into the possession of her father, how did he get a hold of it? There's a lot of questions there that are unanswered, but it still presents a very intriguing case. But again, even now we still don't know who was Jack the Ripper. And for all we know, there might have been more than one person doing these murders around London's Whitechapel.